chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be connecting in with Tony Gosling out of Bristol, England. And he has quite a site. Bilderberg site on the web. We have that up on our page, so come in to thesecrettruth.com and you'll be able to click on that and go to his extensive Bilderberg site. We have the Bilderberg group that's going to be meeting next week beginning June 7th, 2018 to June the 10th, 2018 in Turin, Italy. And Turin was quite a motor city. You know, they're in Italy, and for motor cars, Italian built cars. And, the group will meet there for, these 4 days. They usually have meetings on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then they leave out of there on the Sunday. So, we don't have a list of topics yet, nor do we have an attendee, list yet. But, they're a very, very powerful group. They meet annually. It's complete secrecy. They're told not to discuss any of the discussions, what went on inside the hotels where they meet. They usually meet at some of the most prestigious, hotels in the world. One year they met in Austria and another year they met in Germany. And they met, I was, at the, Copenhagen meeting 2014. I was there conducting a symposium called We the People Bilderberg. So, I have some knowledge about these people and I've seen them up close, you know, firsthand. And they're the most powerful people out of Europe and America. They're kings and queens in there, or their emissaries, their representatives are there. There's central bankers. There's a British, financial magnate, so to speak. There's some very, very big kings and queens, people that own Dutch Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, people like that. I mean, it's very, very rich people. And they plan for the world what they want us to go, what direction they want us to go in. And it's sort of a management group from one of the highest levels ever, as to what they want to see carried out, what kind of, dynamics and what kind of goals that they're setting for the world at large and so forth. And they do make things happen. They invite people that are on the up-and-coming political, you could say, drive to dominate their countries. They always have future-oriented people that usually become presidents or prime ministers of their countries or some of the leading business people. They cultivate and some very, very influential and rich, like themselves, people to elevate. And they promote some of these people and elevate them to higher levels and so forth. So this is what they're all about, you know, is to formulate, to structure, to set into motion certain policies and so forth for the remaining part of the year after that. And they make things happen. They're rich and they're very influential and they're very powerful. But we don't see them as a very good force in the world. It's all money driven. So it's all this very, very dominant money, the big money. And at the big money, there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of evil and there's a lot of esoteric types of things going on. So I can't say that I support them in that way. And we just have to observe what they're doing and then report it to the public at large and just see if we can get this public out there to wake up a little bit, you know. Maybe they will, and maybe they won't. Here we go with Tony Gosley. Welcome to The Secret Truth. And I want to welcome Tony Gosley back to The Secret Truth. Welcome, Tony Gosley from Bristol, England. We're glad to have you back.
Hi, George. Always a privilege to speak to your you and your Austin audience. I think, you know, I always try and actually I've got this sort of thing in my mind about Austin and Bristol, because I think we've got a lot of similarities, you know, because Bristol is in a way the sort of epicenter of the UK. Lots and lots going on in the city, a very conscious city, loads of different cultures all kind of coming together, but all basically pulling together against the New World Order. And I think you've got a similar thing going there, haven't you?
Yes, we do. We really do. We've got Alex here, and I've been at this for 35 years of work, you know, working in this area, you know.
Yeah, and also I think, am I right in saying that Bill Hicks was from your town?
Yes, Bill Hicks was here, and Alex was good friends with him. We have a very creative community here in Austin, you know. Music, you know, we've all written music here, a lot of us have, you know. So that's
well, what
one
we
of
say
the
about the Americans, I don't know if you know this, a lot of Brits, when we're talking about the Americans, we say that America has got the best and the worst of everything.
Yeah, it used to be around here in Austin where you'd meet people on the corner, they were all songwriters. Then there was a period in there 10, 15 years later where they were all computer programmers, see? You know what I mean? So we're a high-tech city, too.
Bristol's a very musical city, too. In fact, it's the most musical city, apparently. More musicians per head of population than anywhere in the country. The only thing, of course, is there isn't any proper music production facilities anymore that actually bring on musicians. In other words, you know, the sort of impresarios that spot good talent, put talent together with good producers in good studios and good marketing to actually make the most of the musicians. At the moment in Britain, probably similar to the US, the actual ability to turn talent into successful culture and songwriting is deliberately being, I mean, a lot of musicians would agree with me. They said that this has been deliberately stopped, you know, because the idea is to turn most of our cultural industries, most of our media into a kind of production line system where basically someone assembles a team of their own choosing. Many of the people have got no actual gift or whatever in media, but they are churning out something like it's on a production line rather than coming from the heart. You know, as Bill Hicks would say, play it from the heart. It's just not happening anymore.
Right. I see the point you're trying to make there. You make a well-founded point. Yeah, they're getting these groups together and managing them and organizing and structuring them for success, you know.
Well, yeah, and what they're doing is I think it's become like a factory. So the idea is rather than bring on existing talent, it's to sort of assemble the various items that should make talent yourself. And what you end up with is almost a kind of pastiche of what good music is. So, but the thing is that there's a deliberate dumbing down in all of our media at the moment. In other words, the point being, at some point in the future, what the power elite will do is they will start to open those floodgates again, allow much more talent, and that, the idea is to give a kind of feel-good factor to their new world order whenever they bring in the future, you know, to sort of kind of cultural renaissance or that kind of thing, to give a feel-good factor right across society, like happened in the 60s and early 70s, you know, that whole period, whilst things like the 67 war was going on in Israel, the destruction of things like marriage as a kind of major institution, things like the legalities around sexuality being changed, and no one really noticed because everyone was having such a good time with all the music dancing away. And there were a lot of changes that happened at that point in history, which were really obscured by the fact that people just had that feel-good factor. So I think that this is a you know, mass cultural manipulation is quite feasible and has definitely been going on, because it is the financial people, the banksters, that really make decide what kind of areas of society are going to be flourishing at any one time, and who is going to be the key people on those various, who get the loans, effectively, who get the loans to do whatever it is they want to do.
Well, you know, last year, before the last year's Bilderberg group, you brought up Ofcom and Sharon White, and she attended there in Chantilly, Virginia. And we don't have a list out yet, do we? But the point I'm trying to make with that Office of Communications is locking down everything they can in England, isn't it, on regulating and licensing all media and press.
But it's not, our show is not being taken off the air.
Yeah.
Press TV has been taken off the air, because I think this is where the epicenter is of much of what's going on in the world, is in Palestine and in the Middle East particularly. I see we just had today a protest at the European Parliament, and where 4,500 pairs of shoes were just placed outside the Parliament in lines, 4,500, to represent the number of murdered Palestinians by the racist Israeli far-right government so far this decade, in the last 10 years. So that's 4,500 people murdered. And, of course, the rest of the much of the world seems to kind of, and the media seems to want to kind of turn a blind eye to this. Actually, we went through, I can remember very well in the 1980s, a long anti-apartheid campaign against South Africa, saying, well, look, this regime in South Africa, the government, is disenfranchising black people. It's basically a black country. It's a white supremacist regime. We had the AWB and which was basically a very, very racist party, far right Dutch kind of inspired party in South Africa. And I don't see that same kind of campaign going on here, particularly represented by the media in Britain against Israel, even though actually what Israel is doing is, in many ways, is worse than what happened in South Africa, because they're not interested in just having second class citizens as Palestinians. They want those Palestinians gone, and they just want them out. They don't want them there. And this is actually far worse than having a structural system whereby one class or one race is in class by society and by the government as inferior to another, to actually to have as an official policy that these people may be wiped out with impunity, because that's what's been happening. You know, brave soldiers from the Israeli Defense Force shooting dead medics, you know, this kind of thing. And I think I'm right in saying it's something like 130 people since the beginning of April now who are doing peaceful protests. I mean, it's quite right to say they're Gandhian-style tactics that they're using. They just want to walk across into the land, or run across into the land which has been stolen from them. And what's happening is they're just being gunned down by soldiers, which is absolutely disgusting and appalling. So 4,500 shoes outside the European Union. But will anyone be listening? Certainly the mainstream media don't seem to want to listen, because they're very, very pro-Zionist. For whatever reason, the Zionist lobby has got in at the top, I think, in most of our mainstream media. And so much of the, many of these atrocities and the analysis of these atrocities is simply not right. being done by the London press, certainly over here.
Well, that Black Cube Corporation, I don't know if you've ever looked into that. But that
I've
is,
heard of them. Never
that
really
is a very, very...
Should, George. Tell us about them.
That's a very bad company. In fact, when Harvey Weinstein was under attack from the first girl, I forget her name, that alleged the his violations, he hired Black Cube to go after her. And it's a very tenacious Mossad, ex-Mossad members head up the company. Okay?
Well,
Yeah, they're basically the thugs.
The heavies, potentially also the jackals, that is to say, the murderers. You know, so I remember when this whole Cambridge Analytica scandal came out, that's when I first came across the Black Cube, and they were saying there that sometimes they were going into jobs and they'd find the person who was their predecessor in the job had been murdered, but they were taking over a job, and effectively they were being very highly paid because it was danger money. Now, this is, we're talking about data analysis here. We're talking about effectively a massive public relations company. But public relations has got into the killing game. That's the trouble. And, of course, a lot of people doing these the PR for these various wars, like faking chemical weapons attack in Duma, that kind of thing, you know, doing this fake footage with the white helmets being trained in Turkey originally.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So this is a murderous industry. There's no regulation, George, and there's no analysis by the mainstream press.
Some information. We're sending troops back into the Syrian area, and they're actually fighting on the ground over there that I know of.
Hang on a minute, because just a month ago, Donald Trump said he was going to pull them out.
Friends of mine have grandsons. They're going in there now. They're on the airline yesterday. They should be in Syria sometime today fighting. And some of their friends have already been killed over there in the Syrian area.
Top, there's a quarter of Syria, which is the kind of triangle at the top. Yeah. That's the southeastern corner,
right,
which is fighting alongside many of the Kurds. So
right.
The problem here is that much of this land is not traditional Kurdish territory at all. So what's happened is the Kurds have been being used by the NATO countries in order to grab oil fields.
Exactly, that's what it is about.
Big Western companies, because of course that's what they're really interested in. You know, I wonder whether Donald Trump really was in the know as to whether the attack on Syria through using this proxy force ISIS was really just about stealing oil from them. And when he was talking about, are we going to have to bring the troops back home, we haven't made any money. Well, he obviously hadn't spoken to the people who'd looking at getting and have already got, with Genie Energy, of course, oil concessions in the Golan Heights, oil concessions in northeast Syria. So this is theft on a grand scale, but it's not being really dealt with like that in the mainstream press at all. It's just being, you know, what they're saying is there's various ethnic clashes, this kind of thing. No, they're just stealing oil. That's all they've ever done.
Marriott and the Rothschilds are in there with Genie Oil in the Golan Heights.
That's right. And also, I think we've got something else going on. I mean, you name dropped Bilderberg briefly there, but the Bilderberg is there's two main strands to it, the way I see it. I mean, obviously, it's a globalist mission they're on, really to just unite Europe to have one president and one foreign secretary for the whole of Europe rather than, you know, lots of different countries. That's the mission that they're on. But there's two main strands to what they do. One is the military strand, and the other is the financial strand. And it's going to be very interesting to see the characteristics of Bilderberg over the next few years. Now we've got no David Rockefeller, because the character of the man was very important to the way that that group worked and operated and what it would and wouldn't do. So it would be interesting to see how that all develops, and you know, it may be that it gets a little bit more reasonable in its and sensible in its approach, or it might be it just gets violent. Who knows? But anyway, the point really being that we've got some serious earthquakes going on in the financial world at the moment. Everyone is scared to death in Europe, at least, you know, the financial elite are, not everyone, that various countries are going to leave the euro. So we've had Italy and Spain, big, big changes this week. I mean, of course, remember the Greeks back in 2016 voted in a referendum against the bailout plans by the Germans. But that referendum was really effectively a referendum on the euro and whether to go back to the drachma or whether they wanted to have a euro or not. They voted against, and they got nothing, really. They got nothing at all. And the Syriza government didn't manage to deliver. And that's why Yanis Varoufakis resigned, because he said these people aren't serious in taking on the international financial oligarchy. This has become because the bankers are so powerful, a lot of politicians, they will talk the talk, but when it actually comes down to it, they're not prepared to take them on. They can't think their way through the financial system well enough to see how a country can kind of challenge it and maybe, you know, construct its own currency, construct its own financial system outside the Eurozone. So in Italy, this has all been very much in the front of people's minds since the March election. Well, during the March election, and now they want to leave the Eurozone. They want most Italians want to leave the Eurozone, and also quite possibly want to leave the EU too. But are they going to get a chance to vote on it like we did in Britain? No. What's happened is a IMF banker has been imposed on the country as a prime minister. This is absolutely anti-democratic. People in Italy are livid. But what they're saying, and of course this was in the one of the German commissioners tweeted it last week apparently, and said it in the European Commission, the markets will teach the Italian people to vote the right way, to vote pro the euro. Because if they start voting against the euro, then the markets will teeter, the markets will crash, and they won't like that very much. So although the psychics predicted the crash in 2022 and 2023, I don't know if you know that, but there's a lot of psychics who've said that that's, you know, I don't really believe in that stuff, actually. And I think a lot of the psychic stuff is actually the intelligence services trying to play with our minds.
Yeah.
But you know, we've got a serious problem with the euro. Okay, Deutsche Bank mainly. So it's lost 42% of its share value just this year. Deutsche Bank down 42% just in the year. Standard & Poor's just yesterday, I think it was, downgraded them from A to B. Now, a lot of people might say, oh, it doesn't make much difference. A to B does make a big difference. It's going from the top rating to a more moderate rating. Like, well, we're not really sure if this bank is quite as, you know, it's a big change anyhow. It's a very important, it's only 1 point change, but it's a very important milestone. So no longer is A rate is
a big red flag, what it is, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course there'll be a lot of people thinking, right, B rated, right, that's enough for me, I'm getting out of here. And of course that kind of thing can precipitate a crash. George Soros as well this week, he's been saying that there's a massive crash is likely. He's also, by the way, been, and of course, all this is all tied together. The threat of the crash, which is effectively like, it's like the gangsters holding a gun to your head. The threat of the crash, because these guys can precipitate a crash whenever they want to, these elite banksters, the Bilderbergers, they can do it. And obviously this will be something that will be being talked about, not necessarily at the Bilderberg conference in Turin in Italy next week, but behind the scenes amongst some of the key players on the steering committee. When are we going to have our crash? Because we're in the situation, the incredible situation, where the banking system around the Western world is totally deregulated, totally. And when I say that, I'd say it advisedly, because look at what's been happening, for example, with Deloitte recently. They have just been threatened with a £10 million fine for a complete fraudulent load of accounting, another load of fraudulent load of accounting. Well, they're not at all scared by a £10 million pound fine, because they have made far more money by making up figures for the books for the various companies that they've been signing off their audited accounts. So if you can create an extra £3 or £4 billion on a company's balance sheet, and then afterwards someone doesn't actually fine you anything, but they threaten you with a £10 million fine, of course you're going to do it again and again and again and again. And the big four accountancy firms, that is KPMG, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, are all doing this. And one thing I'd just love to know, and I did look at this the other couple of months ago, but I couldn't work it out, is who is auditing these auditors? And it wouldn't surprise me if Deloitte were auditing PricewaterhouseCoopers, and PricewaterhouseCoopers were auditing Deloitte's, George.
God, I mean, that's something to think about, isn't it? Huh? Yeah, who audits the auditors?
What they do is they just make figures.
Yeah, yeah.
They're making up figures.
Right, fictitious. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
The other thing is, we've also had this, which is also another big, like, not necessarily a red flag, a flashing red light with a siren, which is the visa payment chaos we've had across Europe yesterday. Millions of people affected for several hours, just not being able to use their visa cards. I don't know if you've heard much about this in the US, George.
No, I haven't heard too much about that.
Right, well, it's affected millions of people between, I think it was sort of early lunchtime for several hours until late afternoon. Supermarkets are having to sort of basically just turn people back, so they filled up their trolleys with food and they just say, well, you can't pay for it, you haven't got any cash and your card doesn't work, so people just have to just leave the trolley there and go home, or go out somewhere else and try and find their bank and go to a cash. Big queues at banks, big queues outside cash points. Now what the Visa people have said, first of all, they said nothing. They didn't give any explanation, just a technical glitch, we're very sorry. And then this morning they announced that it was a hardware failure. Now, do you know what? That I just don't believe that at all, because all of these major financial systems have got hardware redundancies. You know, so that means if one bit of hardware goes wrong, there will be a few seconds where it won't work, but you won't even notice that if you're making a payment, because the backed up details will be on another system somewhere, and that will kick straight in. And you won't even notice it. Now, everybody that is in financial circles and anything to do with IT in finance knows this. But the general public don't, and obviously the journalists don't, because they don't even question. So this is I would suggest this is a lie put out by Visa. And I would also suggest that this is a kind of an economic warfare against the public exercise, George.
Right. It could be a foreshadow of real insolvency or illiquidity. That's
well,
it.
Irving King, right, I think was the last decent, I mean, you know, he's not kind of amazingly dynamic bloke, but I think he was a fairly honest man. And he was the previous to Mark Carney, who's from the Bank for International Settlements, virtually a financial criminal, man responsible for the deregulation that caused the 2008 crisis, Mark Carney. King came out in March, I think, maybe it was February, and said, there's another crash is going to come. And he gave the figures as well. He said there's a debt bubble, and the size of it is £166 trillion.
Oh,
it's going to come back. So we've had all these various warnings. George Soros is warning. Mervyn King is warning. Deutsche Bank is warning. Visa cards are warning. So I just think we've got to be really aware that this could happen at any time. And in the meantime, in the background to all of this, we've got this potential crisis looming between Gaza and the Israelis, and the movement of the embassy to the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and the Israelis started to get very trigger happy against civilians who don't happen to be the same religion or race as them. I think we've got some fairly serious things going on this summer, George, that, you know, I haven't seen these various planets lining up to warn of war and crash for I've never seen so many signs at the same time.
Well, the Iranian Israeli thing is building up big too.
And what about this Ukrainian Arkady Babchenko this week, the journalist? Okay, so what happens there is there's the murder of a so-called murder of a Russian journalist in Ukraine who's very anti-Putin, but the whole thing was staged apparently with pig's blood. And then at the press conference where they're talking about this guy's murder, the guy turns up. He's actually not been killed at all. So do you know what I think? I think the Ukrainian secret police are just playing games with us. And actually what's happened is, I think it's backfired on them, because many of the journalists that I've been listening to and reading in the West are saying things like, well, we can't ever trust the Ukrainians again after this, because we ran with that story for 5-6 hours. And we believed it, and we don't like being lied to that extent. The other thing is that the story itself doesn't stand up at all, and the journalists can see this. They may not be writing about it, but I can assure you they've noticed these various things. The assassin is supposed to be a monk, a deacon, is a religious man. He's supposed to be the hitman. Now, maybe the Ukrainian authorities have got something against him. They want to fit him up. But it certainly doesn't sound like a hitman to me. And then the paymaster of the so-called hit against this journalist, which never was, is a director of the Schmeisser machine gun factory, which is a half Ukrainian, half German owned. I mean, I don't know if you remember from the Second World War, they used
pistols where they're still
They're still making. And this guy is supposed to be the paymaster of this hit. Well, it just doesn't make any sense at all, because they're saying that they would have, that what they wanted to do was to wrong foot them. But of course, the guy who was supposed to be the hitman would have known that he hadn't actually killed this journalist. Look, what I think they're doing is they're copycatting on the British Skripal case, that they've seen what the British have got up to down in Salisbury back in February, was it the beginning of March, and they've said, oh, we can do something like this, we can fool the world, and we can have a laugh at the Russians' expense, and we can have a go at the Russians, and a provocation in the run-up to the World Cup. But actually what's happened, George, is it's backfired spectacularly, because it's now totally reduced any kind of belief or trust by Western journalists in the Ukrainian system, Ukraine as a country. And I think that they've really shot themselves in the foot quite literally here with this ridiculous facade fantasy back on Wednesday this week.
Can the Ofcom, that's a good point. Can the Ofcom regulate the BBC at all, or to some degree?
They do have a bit of a role, but, I mean, the BBC, I mean, we all have a go at the BBC, but you know what, I love them. And you know why? And it's a silly thing, because if it wasn't for the BBC, we would be getting wall-to-wall Rupert Murdoch, and that means Sky, The Times, The Sun. You know, it's just horrible, the Murdoch press. It's worse than the BBC. It's more manipulative. At least the BBC, you get some of the truth. Okay, so a lot of it is rubbish and nonsense. And also, it's generally a salvageable organisation if you get better people, put good people on the executive board of the BBC, good people on the trustees board of management of the BBC. So, you know, so you've got a good executive, a good board, you know, you could actually start producing some good programmes again. But, yes, of course, it's used as a propaganda arm. And I don't think there's many British people that just simply don't really believe what they're saying anymore. But anyway, so what about predictions for Bilderberg?
Right, what about them? Do you have anything in your head yet or not? We don't have a list yet of attendees, right?
No, but I mean, it'd be interesting to see who does go. Keep an eye on the British attendees. Jacob Rees-Mogg may be there.
Okay.
He's one of the people who's been earmarked as potential to take over from Theresa May before the next general election here. And he's very much a Eurosceptic. And so he's, you know, anyone who's a likely possible British Prime Minister is likely to go there. So that's the other thing is their timing is amazing, isn't it? So they've just had literally yesterday sorted out the Italian government. They've got rid of what the people wanted with the left wing and the right wing Eurosceptics, and they've got a prime minister who's pro-EU. So, you know, you're getting basically a topsy-turvy government which is doing completely opposite of what the people actually voted for. So this is a great victory for Bilderberg, and I imagine they'll be all slapping themselves on the back when they meet in Turin next Thursday. Obviously, Kissinger is one of the major figures there. We've got people like Eric Schmidt, major figure. Peter Thiel, a major figure. And the tech giants and the bankers, effectively, are the major people. But then there's also this smattering of royalty that always turns up, and big owners of big media. Often people miss them, but it's usually somebody from the Murdoch group, whether it's from News International, whatever they're called nowadays, you know, the holding company for the Murdoch empire is usually there. But it's always fascinating to read that list when it first comes out, and also to see what they say they're going to be talking about. I remember last year, one of the things on the list was plastic. What is going to happen with plastic? So they've got this kind of fake environmental angle to them, where, you know, there's this massive environmental movement, for example, against fracking, but none of that's going to appear at Bilderberg. What you do get is a whole load of stuff about plastic and how we can impose taxes on plastic. And that was, it was really interesting to see how that guy, just simply that guy turning up at Bilderberg, suddenly the whole campaign against plastic gets a pat on the back. And right across Europe, they've had all sorts of new laws coming in against plastic waste, that sort of thing. I'm not saying that's bad, but it's all been driven by them. It's not happened naturally or normally through governments. The Bilderbergers are doing all this stuff. Also, I would suggest that they will be looking at ways of doing something about what's happened in Syria, because the Russian intervention 2 years ago in Syria has been an absolute game changer. Assad has got his country back, most of it, at least probably three quarters of it, maybe a little bit less, but he's now in a position to tell the Americans to get out of his country. Which he's absolutely right to do. But he's actually now in a position where he's strong enough back as Prime Minister to do that. And Syria always was going to be a very important key to all of this. And it's basically a victory for the Russians. And the West has just failed. It failed, number one, to take hold of the country, to destabilize and destroy the regime like they did to Iraq and Syria, in Libya and Afghanistan, which basically turned Afghanistan into a massive opium farm run by...
Yeah, that's right.
It was run by the Taliban in a reasonably sensible manner. The local people liked the Taliban, the laws that they brought in. Some of them were a bit strict, but it was basically a moral religious law system. But now it's just gangster run, and all they're doing is growing opium. So they wanted to do something similar, basically divide and ruin to Syria, and it's failed.
They could rename the Bilderberg the Spectre Group.
They're kind of winning in one way, George, but they're losing in another. They're winning on the ground, they're winning territory, they're destroying the opposition, but they're also losing hearts and minds around the world. And the world is waking up to who these people are. Look at what's happened with Turkey, for example. The Turks have done a 180-degree switch from being basically pro-NATO, let's go along with this gangsterism, to totally anti-NATO. And they're saying starting to say a lot of sensible things now, Erdogan has been. For example, turning against this massive US intervention. Obviously, he wants to steal a bit of land at the north of Syria, and he's got that. But, he's now much more aligning with the Russians, buying these Russian anti-aircraft missiles and things like that, so he can shoot down American planes if he needs to. And he realizes the real enemy is the West. I don't know, though, George. I'd just like to hear from you whether you think the Brits or the Americans are really running this transatlantic alliance, this special relationship. Who's in the driving seat?
Well, it looks like to me that they're trying to promulgate a war because of the financial, problem still. And they've never overcome the debt problem.
Is London in charge or was it Washington in charge? Or is it Tel Aviv?
No, London is still the financial center and the Rothschilds. But the Rothschilds have moved some of their operation to America also.
Yeah.
Because of the Rockefellers, they took over some of the Rockefeller interest, financial interest, made a deal before David died, what I understand.
So, yeah, I mean, the other thing is that Europe is starting to, it's really interesting what's been happening with Spain and Catalonia.
Well, Hungary is a key that they hate that, what happened there.
I think basically the EU project of unification has failed. But the people who are behind it, the Soroses of this world,
yeah,
are angry that their wonderful dream has been smashed of controlling the whole of Europe. What we're talking about, 700-800 million people. They wanted to get them all under their own one shackle. They failing to do that. And I wonder whether the backlash will be, so if you are going to scupper our plans for the euro currency, the single basically, United States of Europe, based in Brussels, controlled by us, then we're going to take all your economies down, and I think that's what they'll do.
Well, what happened that I think, is that
happens, and you know, potentially the slow breakup of Spain, you know, through Catalonia, that's now just immediately gone through as soon as Rajoy, the People's Party, effectively a fascist leader, prime minister in Spain, has now been gotten rid of just this week. As these countries start seceding from Brussels, seceding from Spain, Italy starts potentially breaking too, then that's when they'll just say, right, we've had enough of this, and they'll bring the whole lot down on everyone's heads in Europe.
I think one of the main considerations and influences was when they lost control of their own central banks, then they couldn't cheat. Now, the currency markets could even things out, you know, in the marketplace.
When you do that, you cede sovereignty. You're saying,
we can
hand over our country to private banks. I remember having a chat with the guy who was from one of the directors of the Bundesbank.
Yeah.
And he was looking a bit sheepishly at me. He retired when I was chatting to him a couple of years ago in Dresden.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, the problem is these private banks are now so much more powerful than we were. You know, so he understands that the private banking system really is a kind of feudal system.
Yes, it is. It's the Bank of International Settlements ties a lot of this stuff together too.
Well, it's the Bank of International Settlements is the king, you know.
Right.
And other major banks, what we're talking about here, people like RBS, Deutsche Bank, these kind of major private banks, they're the dukes, you know, so they're the next one down the feudal chain. And these are the people that, first of all, they're obsessed with money. They think that money is the only thing that really matters in this world. And, you know, obviously the money is the root of all evil. These are the money changers that Jesus throw them out of the temple.
Which,
by the way, was what got him on the cross.
That's right, exactly. Let's be
clear about this. That is what got the Jewish establishment of the day so annoyed with the guy, you know, because he did that in their temple. So this is our temple, you know, we own it. Look, I've got the title deeds to this temple. Someone does that in here, I'm afraid that we've had enough of them. And that was the bravest thing he did, I think. And
well, 30 years before Jesus, they instituted the Pros Bowl, okay? The Pros Bowl, P-R-O-S-B-U-L. Halil the Babylonian, acting as the Nasi of the council, he instituted the Pros Bowl, which overrode the forgiveness of debt during that beginning of that seventh year. And so they were able to continue to lend even during the seventh year, which they were prohibited from doing under the sabbatical rules and laws.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we need to just make sure that money serves humanity. If we're going to have money, which I don't actually believe we need, but if we're going to have it, in fact, it was pre-Roman Britain, we didn't ever have money, really. I mean, obviously have valuable things, but certainly no one's going to say, well, you can't eat, you know, because you haven't got any money. No one was ever going to say that, but they are.
What Charlotte and I have always supported was something like community banks that are owned by the deposit holders.
See? Yeah,
way you diffuse the money, the dominance of money, the monopoly of money creation, you diffuse that power.
Here's a policy you won't hear on the mainstream press, right?
Yeah.
And that is that we need to get rid of any kind of payment for basic essentials of life, so such as food, water, shelter. These basic things all should be available to anybody for nothing. And let's just use a taxation and use money for things which are more like luxuries. And that just seems to make sense to me. And then what happens is you get nobody, you know, begging on the streets, nobody, you know, lying, if I can say that, this in their own urine, which is what happens to people when they fall off the bottom of the ladder. Let's just make sure that everyone has got the things that they need to live, the very basic stuff. Then they realise, if society's given me this, well, that's great. That's a good society, and I'm going to contribute to that society. But if society takes those things away, people actually start to resent the society around them and the system that they're in. But look, one of the other things is, you know, is the things we don't hear about. You know, something I haven't heard about for a while, that's Julian Assange.
Oh, that's right. Well, they made a deal with him for him to remain, but he can't communicate it on political matters.
Okay.
So he's basically been gagged. So right. Here is the most radical publisher in the world.
Right.
The person who the whistleblowers all go to, saying, here, Julian, right. We've just found out this, blah, blah, blah. But he has been muzzled. Now, this is not a free press. This is not a free West. This is not a free country in Britain where we can do that to a man who's effectively a producer, journalist, editor of one of the most important investigative websites in the world. In fact, some of the stuff on that WikiLeaks I've seen myself is leaks from GCHQ and the NSA talking about how they want to control journalists. I mean, we all know about Operation Mockingbird, where the intelligence services decided, I think it was in the 50s and 60s, maybe you can help me out here, George, but Mockingbird was about total control.
Yeah, it came out of Alan Dulles created that. When he was CIA director. It was in the 50s, yeah.
So what they're saying, effectively, is that even somebody like Julian Assange, who's a great entrepreneur, the most radical, brilliant publisher in the world, he's not allowed to do anything. All we're allowed is official government and intelligence service approved news. Hang on a minute. This is totalitarian system. What they're doing is they're trying to stifle criticism and stifle any kind of proper debate and journalism. This is another thing that makes me more and more worried, increasingly worried about the potential of war and crash, because these two things, I think, are going to come together. Now, at some point in the future, God knows when, and I don't think we will know until it actually happens. And when it does, things are going to change very rapidly. I mean, for example, the visa outage, I was saying, an exercise potentially for the day when the crash comes and everyone suddenly can't get at their money. And this is a way of just saying, well, let's just try it out, see how, you know, how switching off the visa. One thing amazes me is our governments don't control these payment systems, the SWIFT payment system. The visa payment systems should be infrastructure in the hands of responsible governments. But no, they're in the hands of people who want to use those payment systems for private profit, for God's sake.
Now, I haven't fleshed this out enough. I just heard it being reported, but the central banks of Africa met recently. And I believe, and maybe you have some information on this, did they go over to the euro for oil sales or something like that, or what? Did you hear that?
I absolutely haven't heard that one, George. Fascinating if it's true.
They just met recently in Africa at a big summit meeting of central banks. Now, this is one reason why Gaddafi, they went after him. He was becoming the leader of the African continent, see? And he was proposing a gold denier, you know what I mean? Dinar. And they didn't like that either.
And yeah, money is absolutely at the heart of all this, and Bilderberg is at the heart of the West's money system.
These people
that go to these conferences control most of the money in the Western world, and if they don't, any of the money they don't control, they have enough influence to decide which direction it's going to flow. So, you know, in a way, they do control all of the money in the Western world. Let's just be a little bit more, you know, push the boat out on that. And the other thing is, I mean, I just want to remind your listeners that we do a program in Bristol. Now, we have a inquiry going on in Britain into child sexual abuse. I remember reading, must be 8 years ago or something, the book on the Franklin scandal over in the United States. The use of child sexual abuse for political purposes, basically. This is what this was about. There was a certain amount of people who were just doing it for their own perverted ends. But a lot of it was about blackmail. That is to say, getting photographs of people with young kids abusing children and then being able to blackmail those people in the future in their political career using those pictures. That was at the heart of it, I think. But we have an inquiry going on in Britain, which has been I interviewed a guy called Mark Watts. He's an investigative journalist, one of the best in the country, actually.
Okay.
And he was one of the key people involved in freedom of information requests for many years. So any journalist that was having a trouble getting information out of government, he was the go-to guy.
Okay.
But he's been following this child sexual abuse scandal and been writing extensively about it for the last 5-6 years.
Okay.
And he was made it absolutely clear The main problem is the Home Office. That is to say, the, you know, Interior Ministry effectively here in the UK. And they have been behind all of the cover-ups. And yet they are now running this inquiry. So they are the wrong people. They should be being investigated, not doing the investigating. They've also cut off various parts of the inquiry they were supposed to be doing. They're not doing it anymore. The woman who's in charge of the inquiry has got a track record of doing nothing to pursue any kind of prosecutions against police officers or social workers that have allowed this to all go on. Who, you know, where someone has reported this to the public authorities, and the public authorities have just turned a blind eye.
Well, that Tommy Robinson case just recently over there.
Ah, right. Now you want to talk about this, because this is a psyop, because Tommy Robinson actually did commit contempt of court. As a journalist, I know you can't do this. He was trying to influence the jury in a court case, and he was warned by the judge, don't do this, because otherwise you'll end up in jail. And you can't do that. When you've got a court case going, I mean, he could even now, George, have wrecked that court case against those individuals. And the reason why people are so upset about this is because Tommy Robinson, by, you know, supposedly trying to do the right thing, could possibly allow these various child abusers to get off, to not be prosecuted because of the way he's been influencing the jury during a live court case. We all know as journalists, one thing you do is if you're going to do any reporting on a court case, it's got to be totally balanced during the live, what's called an active case. That is from the moment someone's charged up until a verdict is read out and the person's been sentenced. You cannot be campaigning to get one verdict or another as a journalist. And this is basic rule of journalism. You can say what you want after the case. You can say what you want before the case.
But then why did they hush up the prosecution and jailing of him like they did? Unless, why didn't they just bring it out in public and that's what he was doing?
It's because there are necessary reporting restrictions on these cases. The case has to be allowed, the jury have to be allowed to see the evidence in front of them without having to read in the newspapers or on social media loads of biased comments one way, saying basically, look, these Muslims should all go to jail, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then that's a basic rule of journalism. And it's not a free speech issue, this, at all. So I'm being, you know, absolutely frank with you. Anybody who has anything between their ears knows if you try to influence a jury during a live court case, you're going to jail. Whoever you are, doesn't matter if you're the Queen, the Prime Minister, that jury has to just be making a decision based on what they see in front of them, the witnesses for and against, for the prosecution and the defence in the court in front of them. And if you're tweeting out, this isn't true, this person's a racist, this one should go to jail, then the very least that will happen to you is that you will get a warning. And that's what Tommy Robinson had. And he ignored that warning by the judge, and that's why he's gone to jail. And I think it's absolutely 100% right that that's happened, because you cannot have...
Well, he had people down there trying to scale the fence at 10 Downing Street, too, supporters. Did you see that down there? It created a ruckus. You know,
you mustn't try to influence a live case. You just mustn't do it. You can point out flaws in the process, but if you start to try and influence the jury, then I'm afraid you're going to get a knock on the door.
Well, now his cameraman was
saying, you don't have a decent justice system. As soon as you start to allow people to try and influence the jury, you don't have justice anymore, George.
Well, now his cameraman the other day on an interview said that they were very careful about what they were saying about that case outside the courtroom on the sidewalk. So
certainly weren't careful about what they were reporting and tweeting about. They certainly weren't. And that's why Tommy's, I think this is a bit of a psyop here, that people are being, you know, again, you know, the idea is that, you know, it's kind of narcissistic attention seeking. I actually think that you've got to just stand back and watch the court case. If you don't like the result, the verdict, then by all means, make a big fuss afterwards. But you are interviewing a live court case, that's it.
Well, the story goes that he had a tanning salon somewhere there in London and watched over a period of time these young people being abused or picked up and taken away and brought back. And he just got fed up with it. And that's why he'd been so active against that.
The thing is, there are two sides to this.
Yeah.
The main real culprits in that case in Rotherham were the police and the social workers. And they were allowed to get off by Alexis Jay, the woman I was talking about earlier, who's chairing the National Inquiry. And the certain police, I believe, should have gone to jail, and certain social workers, I believe, should have gone to jail. Now, if I go to a police officer or a social worker and report a child is being sexually abused, I expect that person to act on that information, not to just ignore it. And if they do ignore it, then that's what we would call, deliberately ignoring it, that's what we would call malfeasance in law. That means that this is a misconduct in public office.
Right.
Misconduct in public office, you can go to jail for life, depending on the severity of the crime. If you're in a public office, you've got a duty to investigate that report of a crime and pursue that crime to the courts if necessary and through the courts. If you don't do that, then I think it hasn't been happening very much, but you should be prosecuted if you haven't done that. If you're a police officer that witnesses, say, a murder, and then you just turn around and walk the other way.
But this Jimmy Savile thing back a few years ago showed how widespread some of this pedophilia is and within some of the top echelons.
That's right. Savile was a bit different.
Yeah.
Although people knew, not many people were actually reporting him to the police or anything, because it was very much a sort of culture at the BBC.
It was
seen as, if you would want to make a fuss about Savile, you'll lose your job. I was chatting to a woman the other day, actually, on our dialect program, which you can pick up on online if you want to, who was working in the 1970s at the BBC. And she was saying, well, when we went into the Top of the Pop studio, everyone just avoided him. When he went to one side of the room, we went to the opposite side. She was a 19, 20-year-old woman at the time, right, working on the production staff of various programs in Shepherd's Bush. Actually, it's Lime Grove, just around the corner, where they were making programs. So this culture at Rotherham was very different. A lot of people were going to the police reporting kids were being abused. And by the way, they were mostly being abused from council care homes as well. So it's public employees that should have been going to jail there. And it wouldn't have been allowed to carry on for 15 years if the police were actually doing their job. Now, this is South Yorkshire Police we're talking about.
Okay.
And the same police who were responsible for the Hillsborough cover-up and the horrendous, which was all to do with the police allowing loads of people to charge into the stadium, and then they came up basically against a brick wall and loads of people got crushed and were killed. And
oh
the police
God.
Were responsible for it. And then they covered it up. I think there was something like 30, 40 people killed in this
oh
terrible
gosh.
Crush. And the police covered it up. That was also South Yorkshire Police. So I think we should be, basically jailing the cops rather than getting all upset about Tommy Robinson.
Right. Well, that's very interesting, Tony.
Well, it's a bit of an insight, I hope. Anyway, I'm going to have to go. Bilderberg next week. If you get your last minute tickets to Turin.
Okay.
And go and see Bilderberg.
Okay.
And it starts on Thursday, finishes on Sunday. On Saturday, they usually go for a walkabout. So that's the place to go and chat to the secret rulers of the world as they're going, doing their wandering around the local area, seeing the sights, doing a bit of tourism or whatever.
Okay, well, that's great,
Tony. I predict this year we'll probably see some interesting new faces. Maybe the Irish Prime Minister will be there. He's a kind of Irish version. Leo Varadkar, I think his name is. He's a kind of version of Macron, sort of bankster. The same kind of guy Conte is taking over Italy. We're starting to get this right across Europe now. It's basically just banksters as prime ministers rather than anyone that the people's elected.
I got you. I will.
All right, George.
Okay. Thanks, Tony. Okay.
Lovely to talk to you.
Okay. Yeah, enjoy. Bye. Good night. Bye-bye.